Everybody, welcome to episode 3 of the Never Hand Over podcast. I'm Adam.
Hey, I'm Brian.
And we have Tim in studio with us today. Say hi, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, I'm predictable.
Today, we have a very interesting episode, I think. We're going to be discussing the early days of the UFC. This may not be everyone's cup of tea, but I think if you're a pro wrestling fan and you don't really care much for UFC, I still think if you were to hit the stop button on this, you're going to miss a very interesting discussion, because later on in the show, we are going to talk some pro wrestling. So stick around. Well, I think you're really going to enjoy what you're going to hear.
We are predominantly a pro wrestling podcast, and generally speaking, on any average episode, we're going to be about 90-95% wrestling and, you know, a little MMA sprinkled in. But this is kind of a special show, getting into the time machine and going back to 1993 to kick it all off. Now, you said that you got Tim in the studio. I, however, am not in the studio. I am remotely joining you guys. I'm outside the McNichol Sports Arena in Denver, Colorado. Site of the first ever UFC.
Okay, come on, man.
It's shuttered up, and it's cold out here. This one guy just asked me if I had money to buy his dad some insulin. I don't know. I'll take him at his word, man.
Yeah, I would imagine it's pretty cold out there in Denver or wherever you are joining us remotely from, even though it sounds like you're in studio right now. So
I mean, you got a great mic on there with a great
wind. The wonders of technology is a wonderful thing.
That's true. So we've got a good list of things here. We're going to talk about the early days of UFC. We're going to talk about our introduction to UFC, some of our favorite events and fights, some wacky characters from the time period. Tim has some thoughts on some of the rule changes that happened during the time. And then later on, towards the end of the show, we're going to talk about some fighters that jumped to UFC, or jumped from UFC to pro wrestling and back, or fighters that jumped from wrestling to UFC.
Yeah.
And then Tim made a comparison earlier on before we actually started recording about how Gracie and Severn is his Hogan and Andre. We're going to let him expound on that a little bit.
Yeah, I'd love to see him extrapolate on that. And I want to also preface this by saying, and I think it's fair to give people a little background, is that Tim and Adam, you guys, your kind of love and passion for UFC is very much of that time period. And you guys probably, during the episode, will kind of get to the point where you maybe dropped off. Why I did watch some of the early stuff as it actually aired, and we'll also talk about that. Currently, you know, MMA is a huge passion of mine, neck and neck with pro wrestling, sometimes more so. I haven't missed a UFC sanctioned fight in over a decade, so I think that's interesting to note that I'm more of maybe a modern fan, and you guys were more fans of the original product and kind of went away from it.
Yeah.
Well, I've said many times before that nowadays I would order a wrestling pay-per-view. I would not order a UFC pay-per-view. I mean, I might go to a bar where they're blasting it, but the reason for that is that wrestlers are trying to entertain me, whereas UFC fighters are trying to win. So you might end up with a show that's all, you know, total blowouts or whatever, whereas, you know, they may not always succeed. At least the wrestlers are going for what will be aesthetically pleasing for you.
Right, and that's a fair criticism. I mean, sometimes that can work in its favor, or also sometimes you might have the unpredictability of like a live sporting event, of a basketball game. It's rare to get that in pro wrestling. We do get surprised from time to time, but that true kind of you have to catch it live is something that's maybe unique, at least between the two, in MMA's favor. Adam, let's go ahead and host us and take us to the...
Yeah, let's go ahead and let's talk about first, before we dive into anything else, I think we should talk about our introduction to UFC. Tim, I know you introduced me to UFC first.
Mm-hmm.
You gave me some tapes that you and your dad had taped off the original pay-per-view broadcasts.
Yeah.
And I actually still have those on my VHS shelf alongside a copy of Rampage 92 from Coliseum Home Video.
You young kids can jump onto Wikipedia and find out what VHS and Betamax and 8-track and all that stuff is, but let's just say it was fancy. We thought we were living large.
That's true, we did. So, Tim, I think maybe you should kick us off with this.
Well, my introduction to UFC was through my dad. My dad's very big into martial arts, always has been. And when he heard about this thing, this UFC thing, the appeal for him was they would take a karate guy and put him in the ring with a boxer, or a jiu-jitsu guy and put him in the ring with a wrestler. And so to him, the appeal was it was a science experiment. It was, let's find out what fighting techniques would work if you got jumped on the street and there was no one there to save your ass and, you know, to break up the fight. So, you know, the rules were very, very minimal. It was just, you know, no biting, no eye gouging, no rounds, just throw people in the ring and let them go. So, and the thing that we all discovered very quickly was that if you didn't know how to grapple, you were going to lose in the early days of UFC. It's kind of funny because I was in Taekwondo at the time, and it motivated me. Watching Hoist Gracie choke out all these karate and Taekwondo guys made me decide to join the wrestling team, which is actually where I met Adam.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
What, seventh grade wrestling team?
Seventh
grade wrestling team.
So, what about you, Brian? Where'd you first encounter this crazy thing?
Well, for me, we had what a lot of people back then, it's not common now, but in the 90s it certainly was, called a black box or a cheater box, you know, but we essentially had one of those, you know, undermarket illegal pay-per-view boxes that you buy out of somebody's garage.
Wait a minute, you're telling me that you took one of those things and you were watching UFC instead of porn?
Well, I think we may have gotten an adult channel, but we had, you know, there were six or seven pay-per-view channels as part of whatever package was present of the day, and there was one called Action Pay-Per-View, which is where you could find your horror and your action and B-movies, but we had seen advertisements, because we had that, you know, our pay-per-view stuff on quite often. We saw advertisements leading up to this event, and being a big pro wrestling fan, the way that it was marketed and advertised capture my attention. Like, I would watch a little bit of boxing here or there, but I never really got pulled into it. You know, the sweet science didn't really appeal to a young kid who grew up on body slams and pile drivers.
Right.
I needed, you know, a little bit, maybe more instant gratification. But this definitely intrigued us. And I remember the night that it aired, we actually watched it live, the first viewing. My brother and my dad, I mean, I think they kind of came and went, but I was there for the whole event, glued to the set. And it was wild. I'd never seen anything like it. I had no, you know, no context. One interesting thing I want to note about this first event, going back and looking at some of the data today, there was 8 fights, guys, in the first show. Combined, the fight time is a little shy of 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The longest fight was 4 minutes. The shortest was 26 seconds. There were several fights that didn't even last 1 minute. 14 minutes of fights, that's less than a 3-round current UFC fight, you know, whether it's an undercard or you know, a televised fight. That's an interesting stat alone, just seeing how the differences are. Now, if you go to a UFC show, whether it's a pay-per-view or a televised event or airing on their Fight Pass subscription network, it's a 3-hour affair. There's usually anywhere between 11 to 13 fights, including prelims. And so a 3-hour affair, that's, you know, it's a lot different. Back then, it was very uncharted territories. It still made for a raucous, entertaining evening in front of the set, though, I'll tell you.
And I would actually argue that the reason why they're so much longer nowadays actually has to do with the time limit and the taking away of the tournament. Because in those days when you knew you had to beat this guy, but you also had to beat 2 other guys, there was no waiting out the buzzer because there was no buzzer to wait out. And also you wanted to put away that guy as quickly as you possibly could so you still had some gas in the tank to fight the next 2 guys.
Yeah,
that's true. And like I said earlier, I mean, you introduced me to UFC. When I first watched these tapes that you gave me, I'm like, what in the heck is this? My first thought was, because I had never even heard of UFC, I thought, where are the ropes? You know, how are they going to bounce? I didn't know it was real. You know, I thought it was just some other form of pro wrestling. I was like, how are they going to bounce people off the ropes? I don't understand this. But the more I watched, the more I really thought it was interesting. And then we ended up taking a jiu-jitsu class in the middle of a cornfield.
Yeah, that was out in Slumberville, Ohio.
Yeah, that was an interesting evening.
Yes, it was. It was your first evening. It was actually my third of those jiu-jitsu classes. And the funny thing is that everything that I had learned in wrestling was wrong.
Yeah, because it was jiu-jitsu. So.
Well, because in wrestling, your objective is to stay off your back so you don't get pinned. And it's funny because when I first joined the wrestling team, when people would shoot on me, I would naturally go into the Gracie guard. So I would end up squeezing the fun out of their middle section or whatever, but I was also pinned in the process. So,
I see. Yeah.
There, didn't it?
Yeah, just a little bit. But yeah, so fast forwarding to jiu-jitsu class, now I'd had 2 years of wrestling rammed down my throat, so I naturally would go to my stomach when I was taken down, which opens you up for a choke. So
yeah.
It was bad.
Yeah, you leave that back exposed. Somebody can sink in a rear naked pretty easily and tap you out. I think one thing, going back again to that first show, November 12th, 1993, UFC 1, you know, as I was watching the event unfold and the tournament format, you know, kind of made it nice because you kind of had a narrative. Hoist Gracie, this little kind of unassuming guy in this karate gi, you know, he won his first fight, didn't think much about it, and then he just keeps on winning. And by the end of the night, we were just like, wow, this guy is like Mike Tyson, mm-hmm. You know, like this guy is, you know, wow, like who's going to beat this guy? We were very excited about seeing him continue to fight because it just blew us away that he was, you know, finishing these guys of all shape and size, all fighting disciplines. It definitely was enticing.
I mean, you mentioned the tournament once, you know, a couple times already, Brian and Tim. You just mentioned the tournament. Why don't we go ahead? We were going to save this for later, but Tim, why don't we go ahead and talk about the rule changes that you wanted to speak on, the elimination of the tournaments and whatnot?
Well, I actually feel that the very, very first fight in UFC, the Savate fighter Gerard Gordeaux versus Taylor Tooley, the sumo fighter, was very, very telling of what was to come in UFC in that they had said that the referee was not allowed to stop the fights, and in the very first match, that's exactly what happens. The referee stops the fight because Taylor Tooley's tooth got knocked out. So,
and sorry to cut you off, but I mentioned this to you earlier. If you go back and you listen to some of the UFC podcast or the UFC history podcast that SureDog.com Rewind did last fall. Fall of 2013, they actually mentioned something about this where Gerard Gordeaux actually had two of Taylor Tooley's teeth stuck in his foot from that kick. And he fought the rest of the night with two teeth stuck in his foot, and then it was eventually hospitalized in Holland for an infection because of that. So anyway, please continue. I wanted to share that little side bit.
All right. But it felt to me as a spectator that they would say, okay, these are the rules and we're not breaking them. And then as they would go, they would, rather than at the beginning of the show say, all right, we're introducing new rules, it would just be, you know how we said the ref's not allowed to stop the fight? Just kidding, that's a rule from now on. And they would kind of change it as they went and be like, wait a minute, back up here.
So yeah.
I found that to be annoying at times. I will say, and another thing that you were talking about, Hoist Gracie, what I was kind of talking about, and we're jumping around here, the reason why Gracie Severn is my Hogan Andre is because it was wrestling psychology in that, like Andre was just bigger than Hogan, and oh my gosh, how can Hogan slam Andre? Gracie was this little dude against this big guy, Severn, and I had been conditioned to like him because he was my champion, and Severn just came off as bigger, not necessarily better. I very much enjoyed the David and Goliath fight, and once they introduced weight classes, that was something that I kind of felt got taken away. So, and that was, I feel, the whole appeal of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, is this was a fighting style where the little guy can beat the big guy. That having been said, you know, there were several UFCs where, like for instance, Ultimate 96 comes to mind, where you have a great tournament on paper, but everyone gets injured. So you don't actually get to see these great matchups that you have envisioned because, you know, they just cannot do all three fights in one night.
Yeah,
I mean, that's still a problem that plagues current UFC. It's not so much the, you know, any more multiple fights on one night due to athletic commissions and whatnot, but just in training and stuff, sometimes you have a fight that you're hotly anticipating and it ends up falling flat. And as we're kind of jumping around, which we are currently, Adam, you had said off record earlier, at UFC 5, I believe it was, that big fight that they pitted Shamrock and Gracie together. If not, you know, Shamrock, who could have been the next candidate? You know, who would have I liked to have seen slotted in there? And I don't know how familiar you guys are with some of the big names out of Japanese MMA, but there's a guy, Sakuraba, who also does pro wrestling.
I've heard of him, yeah.
His name is, he is known as the Gracie Hunter or the Gracie Killer. He has wins over four of members of the Gracie family, but his initial fight with Hoist lasted 90 minutes, which is crazy because the longest fights that, you know, Shamrock and Seven of those guys were having were around 30, 33, 36, actually, was the draw of Shamrock Gracie at UFC 5. So can you imagine multiplying that by three?
Well, Shamrock has said, and granted, Shamrock has proven to be a somewhat unreliable narrator with regard to his own life, but he's said that when training for that, he said that when he met Gracie in UFC 1, he saw that Gracie's wearing a gi, so he goes, oh, this is a karate guy. So he said that he shot in quickly and didn't protect his neck because he didn't think he would need to because he didn't actually watch Gracie's fight earlier in the night, didn't see, oh, this guy can grapple, and so he got choked out. So he said that when he agreed to fight Gracie for UFC 5, he wanted to actually make the fight take 2 hours. He wanted to show that he had more endurance and wear him down and then, you know, just slowly destroy him. And allegedly, the night before UFC 5, they came up to him and said, oh, by the way, the fight has a half an hour time limit, because that was when they first introduced time limits. And it was like, oh, you know, do you change your strategy now? You've been training, you know, 6 to 8 months for this marathon of a fight, and at the last second you've been told the rules just changed on you.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting – but the thing about that is with TV time limits, you know, I'm sure if this was not a televised product, which is where they were getting their revenue at that time, like the first ever show, you know, drew 7,800 people, but on its buy rate was over 86,000. You know, I can't fault the UFC too much for saying, hey, you know, we got to keep the show within a 2.5 hour time slot.
Agreed. Well, UFC 7, it kind of had the WCW Halloween Havoc problem where it went off the air during the middle of the main event because it just went way too long. And as I recall, they had to refund a lot of pay-per-view buys because of that. So, like, I get every one of the rule changes in terms of making the product more marketable and also making sure that the fighters get less injuries.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
You mentioned.
I think, and, you know, Shamrock, he's not, you know. I mean, it's easy to, you know, see some of the interviews that he does now, kind of think of the guy as a lunkhead or maybe an inflated, sense of self.
Which hurts because...
But I don't mean this as a backhanded compliment because what I'm trying to get around to saying is, like, he did have submission skills demonstrated even in the first UFC.
Yeah.
He won his fight in the quarterfinals with a heel hook. In a minute, you know, a little under 2 minutes. So he did know some grappling and some stuff. I guess we'll have to take him at his word about why he lost that first Gracie fight in 57 seconds.
Yeah, he takes a little bit of truth in some of these statements and just kind of stretches it as far as it'll go until it breaks.
Well, the other thing he says about that fight is that when Gracie was choking him out, he'd actually taken his arm out of his sleeve and was actually just choking him with the arm of the gi. So I don't know about that. I've tried watching it to see that, and it's like, I don't think so.
But yeah, that's the Gi-Gate controversy, I think.
I mean, if I can find 35 minutes to go back and watch that fight, I will. But
No.
The very first one. Okay, I thought you were still talking about the super fight.
No, their first encounter.
You mentioned also earlier about the elimination of tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
You want to expound on that a little bit?
In what way?
Was it good, bad?
Well, UFC 9, I think, flopped. I mean, you and I were even just talking about the fact that we watched it, but don't remember anything about it.
Yeah, I don't remember a single thing about it.
You know, I think ultimately it was definitely the right call, although I don't think that – I think having it for some of those initial shows was a good way to introduce the product because it felt like, you know, these movies that we grew up in that time frame watching, like Bloodsport – you know, these guys pitted against each other and this grueling night of competition. I think it was a great way to kind of kick open the door and introduce the world to the product. I think ultimately, longevity-wise, as a model, a business model, it would not have lasted. I mean, even Bellator has finally given up the ghost of doing their tournament-based style, and theirs wasn't even single-night tournaments. They were done over the course of a couple months.
Today tournament was that you had going into UFC. Did you know any of those guys' names? No, I never heard of those guys.
Yeah, I didn't know them either.
So at least when you watched the tournament, by the end of the tournament, you knew who they were, assuming they didn't get injured and there was an alternate taking their place, like in Steve Jenham's case. But once they have names, then yes, putting up a marquee, you know, having this name versus that name, obviously is the better way of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tournaments, like you said, Brian, I think the tournaments early on, it was good, helped introduce fighters. You kind of got the feeling that it was just like it was a one night only thing. Like, you shouldn't be watching this. You really shouldn't. You know, but in the long run, yes, I do think it was a good idea to kind of move away from the tournament format once you got more established. I mean, yes, you could use – I think in some of the later UFCs, they started using the tournaments to where the tournament winner would maybe get the super fight on the next card. I could be wrong about that. I mean, could be mistaking it for something else, but
– Well, they also – they kind of split them up into mini tournaments. Like they did. Like instead of eight-man tournaments, they did a four-man middleweight tournament and a four-man lightweight tournament.
Yeah,
and
they
actually
started that. I think UFC 10 was the first show they started that at, and that came along with the introduction of the weight classes. So.
I mean, I think some people could even argue and possibly favorably that, you know, Pride did tournaments better than UFC did. Actually, I think the majority of people who are familiar with some of those huge shows that they did in the 2000s could argue that. I do think, you know, it was good initially to create a hierarchy and introduce these fighters to the world. But now, you know, currently with wins, losses, winning streaks, you know, earning your spot, not only is it probably a better situation for the promoters, but I think it's better for the fighters and their health as well.
I think so, too, because if you look at a lot of those early tournaments, they didn't have gloves on, so a lot of these, they would just punch and punch and punch, and they would end up breaking their hands.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
You had alternates like Steve Jenham, and in the Ultimate tournament where Tank Abbott fought the alternate Steve Nomark and almost threw him over top of the cage wall. Mm-hmm. The cage fence. So
speaking of gloves and ungloved, do you guys have any thoughts on Art Jimerson, who fought with one boxing glove against Royce Gracie at UFC 1? What an odd look. I think I saw that replicated somewhere, maybe in some fighting video game. I know those were all the craze of the 90s. But what a weird... I don't know what he intended to do with one boxing glove.
I don't know what he intended to do with it either.
Well, I realize you didn't know who Gracie was at the time, but if there was one person that you wanted to be able to use your fingers and actually be able to grapple with, that would have been him.
To try to pry
him off of you. You've got this glove. You basically, might as well tie a hand behind your back.
I know that the Gracie family had a hand in the development of UFC, and I have to wonder if they went, you know, can we make sure that Hoist goes up against that guy first? And by the way, please wear the glove. It'll be good for you.
I don't even know what his thought process was behind the glove. I mean, because he was a boxing guy, or as Bill Wallace on UFC, on commentary on UFC 1 so eloquently put it, he was a boxing person.
Yeah. They had just the greatest announcers at the time.
I know. They were just top-notch announcers, let me tell you.
Making the case for the glove, the one, like you kind of talked about earlier, it does protect your knuckles, so you don't break your knuckles. But the other thing is kind of going into the history of boxing, which kind of came from these bare-knuckle tough man contests back when they first started, there weren't a lot of knockouts. The boxing glove provides extra weight, and that's where you're getting a lot of your knockouts. So
that's
maybe
true.
He was thinking, I'll get knockout power with this big glove
here. It could be, or it could just been a way to represent his style, because if you just come down in the American flag trunks or whatever it was he had on, no one was going to know what he was. But if he had the one boxing glove on...
Branding. It's all about branding.
It's all about branding.
Yeah.
All about branding.
Submissions, too, like... Today's current product, I saw a pie graph a while ago for like 2014, and so a big chunk of it, the majority of it was like decisions, then it was knockouts, and then submissions was the smallest of the three. I'm looking now at the data for UFC 2, which had a lot of fights. The opening round itself had...
It was a 16-man
tournament. Yeah, the opening round itself had eight bouts, and I'm looking at the fights here. 7 of the 8 fights in the first round were submissions. 50% of the quarterfinal fights, 2 out of 4 were submissions. Both of the semifinals were submissions, and the final was submission. That one was via punches. But, you know, seeing people tap out, I guess, is less common now. It's a pretty definitive way to get a victory. And I don't know if that's just a technique thing where it kind of caught up to itself and people got so much better as far as technique to eliminate that. I assume that's probably the case.
I think it has to do with a rule change that Big John McCarthy had to put in there. And that was before it was either tap out or knockout or corner throws in the towel. Well, the corner's not going to throw in the towel. In many cases, they were threatened with, don't you throw in that towel.
Yep.
So at what point, you know, are they knocked out? Eventually, McCarthy had them put in a rule where he's allowed to stop the fight if fighter cannot intelligently defend themselves.
And that was actually after UFC 2.
Yeah. And I think that had a lot to do with it. So, yeah, these guys were getting pummeled and beaten, but they weren't tapping out, well, mostly because their hands were up blocking the punches. And, you know, they're not unconscious, so they've not been knocked out, but, you know, even though they've clearly lost the fight, I think that has something to do with why the submission was the way to go in the early days.
I think so, too. Yeah. So we've talked about the rule changes that you wanted to discuss. Let's move on to some of the some of our memorable slash favorite events and fights and some of the wacky characters that resided in the UFC during this time period. Personally, one of my favorite events from this time period is UFC 6.
Agreed.
To me, that encompasses everything that the UFC was back then. It was brutal. If you just watch that first fight, Tank Abbott and John Matua, it's what, 30-some seconds, and Matua goes out in an oxygen mask. That's, to me, that's just, you know, everything the UFC has advertised itself to be, just straight brutality. And from there, I mean, a lot of the fights don't go too long. I think the longest, besides the final, the longest fight may be, you know, a couple minutes.
There was only one long fight on that show. And again, I think if you saw this on VHS, which I presume you did, I think it did get edited quite dramatically. Oleg Taktarov and Tank Abbott went almost 18 minutes in the finals.
Yeah.
But also, too, that Matua fight was well, there was two alternate fights. I don't know if those even got recorded, but there were three other quarterfinals before that Tank Abbott fight. So I don't know if on the video, if it got put on first just to kick things off with a bang.
I don't think any of those alternate fights from back in the day aired. I think the video, I remember renting it from the local library, and it kicked off with the Tank Abbott fight, the Tank Abbott-John Matua fight. Tim, I think you're pulling up the bracket now, aren't you?
Yeah, that was the first of those, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like the longest fight in the tournament was 17 minutes, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
But
we got introduced, I don't know if that was his first show, maybe second, Paul, the polo bear of Arlen's, was on that show.
Yeah, he's someone we can mention later on, too, when we talk about fighters that jumped from UFC to wrestling and back.
We kind of talked, too, about personalities, and this is also kind of bridging a couple of our segments. You know, Ken Shamrock obviously is a guy we're going to talk a little bit more about later as a pro wrestling guy. But I always wondered why his adopted brother Frank didn't do more pro wrestling. I think he technically did some work stuff in Japan as far as like work fights. But he had the look. He's actually a much better speaker and more charismatic than his brother Ken. I think some, maybe most, would argue he was a better fighter in terms of his skills. So I wonder why he never made the jump. Maybe he just didn't want to follow in his brother's footsteps into...
There was a recent documentary that just came out on Frank, and I guess he had... I haven't seen it, so don't be taking this as gospel. Look it up. But supposedly, he had a lot of substance abuse problems that were going undocumented. So
yeah, I watched the documentary that I don't think... one of it was maybe a year and a half or two. And then basically, it wasn't a documentary as much. It was a television special when Bellator was, you know, kind of newly entered into Spike TV and the cable network market. And basically, the premise was at the end of the show, almost like a sensational, you know, program, was at the end of the show, they were going to have a sit-down with him and Ken. So it built up throughout the show, him and Ken getting together. And it was very awkward, man. Not so much that it seemed forced, although it did. it just was uncomfortable. The tension, from what I can gather, is real between the two men, and obviously they have a lot of bones in both of their closets. But
yeah, it's something I mentioned to you earlier, Tim, when you came over before we started recording. Obviously, Ken Shamrock has more name value than Frank Shamrock.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to strip away the name value and just look at their MMA careers, who do you think had the better career?
Unquestionably Frank.
Personally, I think Frank Shamrock as well.
Well, Frank beat Tito Ortiz when he fought him.
Yeah.
Ken can't brag that.
No.
Out of 35 fights, Frank Shamrock was 23-10, and honestly, if he would have hung up the tights a little bit sooner, he would have avoided a couple losses that regrettably he suffered. His last fight, just double checking my facts here, his last fight, was against Nick Diaz, and man, that was a hard one to watch. Diaz was on point. Diaz throws more volume than almost any striker in MMA history, and he was just sliding him up like a pinball machine, man, and that hurt.
Oh, man. So, but anyway, getting back to kind of the early UFC days, because I think we may have veered off there with the Frank Shamrock stuff, but even though he's sort of involved in the early UFC days, but some of the – Tim, what would you – I mean, you said UFC 6 is one of your favorite events.
Yes. It was another instance of the Hogan-Andre fight between Takhtarov and Tank there.
Right,
even more so because Severn definitely he had an athletic look, whereas Tank, well, he had a big belly on him and even bragged about being a barroom brawler. Whereas
that was pretty much Tank was a barroom brawler, man. I think pit fighting was just a made up discipline.
Yeah,
so, I mean, Brian, what are some of your favorite of events from the early days?
Well, you keep talking about that term, and it actually reminds me. Yeah, UFC 8 was actually titled David versus Goliath.
Yeah, it was the that tournament. Yeah.
Yeah, Shamrock and Chemo. But thinking back, for me, favorite events. Anybody know anything about Dothan, Alabama? UFC 12 Judgment Day.
I've not seen it.
I was actually thinking about queuing that up earlier. I just got a bunch of the early UFC DVDs in from the local library.
Is that the one, though, where like there is no main event because everyone is injured? No,
that was the one we were watching. That was UFC 10.
Okay.
The UFC 12, Brian, I think I know the one you're talking about. Was that the one where they had booked for Niagara Falls and they had to move it to Dothan, Alabama, like the day of the show?
Yeah, that one, you had a heavyweight and a lightweight kind of tournaments sort of brackets, you know, going on. Dan Severn and Mark Coleman was a super fight on that show, which Coleman won, with a neck crank.
I've never seen, I like I said, I just got these DVDs in from the library, so I'm going to watch them as many of them as I can before I take them back.
Well, one person you will recognize if you're familiar with current stuff is a very young Vitor Belfort.
Oh yeah,
who wins in the heavyweight bracket? Which is funny because now he fights a couple weight classes lower than that. And actually, in 2015,
just lightning.
in 2015, in a couple months, actually, he will be fighting for another world title. Almost a decade later, 9 years later.
I mean, if you mentioned his hands were lightning, look at that fight from Ultimate Brazil. Who was it? It was against Wanderlei Silva.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just absolutely destroyed him.
And it's funny that you mentioned Ultimate Brazil because another one of my favorite shows, and maybe not so much because of the content, but just because it's one I remember renting several times from the video store, was Ultimate Japan.
I've never seen any of those.
Yeah, I had Ultimate Japan and Ultimate Brazil both happened to be one of the more common tapes I would find at my local video stores. And that one's got a lot of the guys that we've mentioned. It's got Sakuraba, it's got Vitor Belfort, Frank Shamrock, Randy Couture, Maurice Smith. So plenty of guys. Tank Abbott's even on the show against pro wrestler Yuji Anjo. That's an interesting one to get your hands on. Or if you're on Fight Pass, just queue it up.
I actually have a VHS copy of Ultimate Brazil. I just haven't gotten around to watching it yet. I bought it like at a half-price books for 50 cents or something like that.
Yeah.
You've been finding a lot of good stuff at half-price books recently.
Yeah.
The Ultimate Brazil show, I mean, that's one of my... Another one I really liked was UFC 14. the showdown. It was Maurice Smith and Kevin Randleman. I know Maurice Smith was in the main event. I think Randleman was the second half of the main event, but I'm not sure off the top of my head.
That was another Alabama show in Birmingham this time.
It was, and they ran a lot of these shows in the early teens. Like UFC 11, 12, and a lot of these shows, they ran down south because those states weren't regulated with athletic commissions. And this was also during the period where they were run off cable and they were on satellite only. But that tape was the first tape I remember buying based just off the name UFC. I had no idea who any of the fighters were.
But do you remember a guy on that show, Adam, called Dan Bobish?
The name sounds familiar.
Because he went on, I didn't know him at that time, but later on I caught him on some Japanese wrestling tapes, and he went on to have a fairly lackluster pro wrestling career in Japan.
Yeah.
Well, talking the relationship between wrestling and UFC, Shamrock had said as much in interviews that because he actually started out in pro wrestling under the name Vince Torelli, and I guess Dean Malenko had actually shown him a tape of Pancrase in Japan, which is what kind of got him into the no holds barred career path, because he watched the tape and was like, I want to do this. So there's always been that sort of relationship between wrestling and MMA as it's known now.
Yeah. And a lot of fighters have jumped from UFC to pro wrestling and back.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess this would kind of go in with the whack with kind of like the characters thing we were going to talk about.
Yeah.
Shamrock and Severn, obviously. UFC 5, I believe Severn actually came out with the NWA world title around his waist.
Yeah.
Remember, too, Kimo came out with a big cross on his back. I think it was UFC 3 was...
Which, yeah, that was 3.
And the announcer said, this is the pro wrestling portion of the program.
Yeah.
But talking to some people that jump kind of back and forth, and we mentioned him earlier, but Ludwig Borga is an interesting example where he was actually Randy Couture's first opponent in the UFC.
Wow.
So he shows up, I think it's UFC 3. It's either UFC 12 or UFC 13. He shows up. He's in this tournament with Randy Couture. He's the first round opponent, and he just looks completely lost. And Couture just dominates him. I have no idea why he even thought this would be a good idea. Going from the WWF, after he got, obviously he was one of the top guys in there in the mid 90s. Then he pops up randomly in the UFC. And then he disappears again. And the next time I hear of him, he's a politician in Finland.
What?
Yeah. And then in January of 2010, he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. So,
snap.
We shouldn't speak too unkindly of the deceased. But he was a guy who was a journeyman, but combat seemed to be the thread that tied his, most of his life together.
Yeah.
Being pro wrestling, grappling, catch wrestling. You know, there was this one program going back to my illegal pay-per-view days, and I don't remember what it was called, but if you've ever played the video game Pit Fighter.
I've heard of it.
Essentially, it's like people fighting in a garage type situation where there's people all around with money, two guys get into the pit. There was a show where, and it was worked, like we could tell it was worked, my brother and I, but it was basically like a Pit Fighter program. But they were trying to give the effect that these people were having, like, bare-knuckle street fights. And I remember recognizing Tony Helm, a.k.a. Ludwig Borga, on that show. And I've been trying to find some, information on that show, but I can't really dig anything up on it.
If anybody has any information on this show, please email us.
If it rings a bell, it would have probably been around, maybe a year or so, close to when UFC was kind of getting off the ground, I would imagine. To try to capitalize on its success.
Yeah, if anybody has any information about the show, please drop what you're doing and immediately email us, nhopodcast@yahoo.com. We'd love to learn more about this random show. Tim, you were getting ready to say something.
Well, actually, it was a question for Brian, because I remember a few years ago there was it was another late fighter that you had drawn some inspiration from. I don't remember his name, but it was the one that had taken the motorcycle trip.
Was it Evan Tanner?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could expand upon what it was that attracted you to, that made you a fan of his.
Yeah, Evan Tanner if you kind of like, if there's a part of your personality that kind of is attracted to the kind of Jack Kerouac, you know, on the road, kind of a wandering, soul-searching, you know, person, also like the Krakauer book Into the Wild, which was adapted for Hollywood by Sean Penn as a film, Evan Tanner was this kind of very interesting guy. He got into MMA by watching, you know, Boss Rutten VHS tapes, you know, in his apartment room. And just giving it a shot and then finding out, hey, I'm pretty good at this. But he was a guy that would post these really awesome, inspirational messages online. He had a huge heart. He just seemed like this great, cool guy, man. And so, like, he would post pictures on his blog of him taking these random 3-4 day road trips on his motorcycle and it breaking down and him pushing it up a mountain. And, you know, like, just all these crazy stories. He was working a lot in his, you know, later days on a lot of positive things, and it was actually one of those kind of trips that led to his demise. He got out in the desert, and we lost contact, and he had purchased a dirt bike, and yeah, he basically ended up, you know, dehydrated and passed away. But he was a guy that, let me see his first UFC fight, just to at least give us a date.
If I remember correctly, it was probably one of the early Zuffa shows.
Looks like UFC 18 was his first appearance.
Really? Wow, that's... I didn't remember he was that early.
I didn't either. I thought it was at least one of the early Zuffa shows.
Hmm.
Before then, he had done some stuff in Pancrase and a bunch of smaller organizations. He got his start in Amarillo, Texas. Not at the Double Cross Ranch, but...
Who did he fight on UFC 18, out of curiosity?
Yeah, UFC 18, let's see. He beat a guy called Daryl Groller, who doesn't have a Wikipedia entry, so he went on to obscurity. But, Evan Tanner tapped him with a rear naked choke.
Daryl Roller, that sounds like somebody that'd show up in IWA Mid-South, you know?
Yeah, working second with Dingo.
Probably.
But yeah, Evan Tanner is a guy that if you kind of missed his era and you're not as familiar with him, do some research on him and, you know, go look at some of his old blogs and stuff, because he was a really interesting cat and definitely a personality. I hope one day he gets inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame. I think that'd be really cool, and I think he would is deserving of the spot.
Yeah, he sounds like a very interesting person. I'm definitely going to have to go back and look up some more of his fights. We were talking about fighters that had jumped.
I'm going to throw something at Tim real quick.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Tim, you used the terminology earlier, you're a champion for Hoist, and I can understand feeling that way. How then did you feel when they trumpeted him back out a few years ago to the slaughter and had Matt Hughes smash him? Did you feel like that hurt his legacy at all? Did you feel that it was worth it to, you know, pop a buy rate and get to see him one more time, or did you were you indifferent towards it?
Well, thing was, Hoist had sort of lost his mystique to me at that point, because he, even though he left UFC behind, he never left fighting behind, and he had been cleanly tapped out a few times since then.
Yeah.
So that was gone. I was in a slightly different spot in my life, so. When I found out that Hoist Gracie was fighting again, I mean, I didn't think he really had a chance, but it made me watch the show.
Yeah.
And so I didn't feel that he had anything to be ashamed of in that fight. I mean, yes, he got his clock cleaned, but, you know, however many punches to the back of the head he took, he never tapped out. No, the one thing that kind of hurt me with regard to Hoist was when he tested positive for steroids a little bit later.
Yeah,
that,
I forgot about that.
That, for first of all, he needed to go to his dealer and ask for a refund because they clearly weren't working because he didn't get any bigger. But
jab it right in there, why don't you?
Yeah, because that hurt more than him losing to Matt Hughes.
He should have went to that guy from the film The Wrestler that was selling him into Randy the Ram. You know,
hey, did you hear Mickey Rourke won his boxing match?
Yeah, I heard he knocked out some homeless guy in Russia.
Yeah. Way to go, Mickey.
You know, I've been reading Jericho's third book this week, and he mentioned that, yeah, Mickey Rourke cracked him pretty hard. He said Mike Tyson, why it looked like he killed him, Mike Tyson didn't even hit him. And he said Mickey Rourke really cracked him right in the back of the head, gave him a nice lump. So apparently he can throw.
Is that book – well, I'm sure it's good. I've read Jericho's first two books, but I just haven't gotten a hold of that one yet.
It is good, but, you know, after I read the first one, I could not wait for the second one, and I kind of felt the same way after the second one. But I feel like his style, it hasn't changed in any of the three books, like the way it's written. Like, I feel like it's kind of losing steam. Like, they're fun anecdotes, but I don't feel like – it's not something I can't put down like the other ones were. You know, which maybe that's okay. I read, you know, 5 pages here or there, put it down, and get back to it. But there's been some interesting stuff so far. A little peek behind the curtain, you know, some friction with Vince and whatnot. But I won't get too far off topic.
Here's a guy, Brian, that actually wrestled around here, and that's remember Ron Waterman?
Yeah, I saw Ron do pro wrestling.
He was in WWF Developmental, actually in HWA here locally in Cincinnati.
Yeah, I saw him a couple times. Most notably, I saw him at one of the Brian Pillman Memorial shows.
I never thought he was all that great, but I could be wrong. I mean, it's been back
much. I think one thing that worked against him is that he had a look that was remarkably similar to Bill Goldberg.
Yeah.
They both were bald. They were both had the same muscular build, the black trunks, the black, you know, gloves. I don't know how much of it was intentional or just, you know, maybe he was cursed to look like the guy who happened to be the biggest star in the world almost at that point. But I think that was, you know, that didn't help.
No, it didn't. And I'm going to have to go back and watch some of Ron Waterman stuff. I think maybe one time I bought a tape.
Adam, let me throw out a theory. I think a lot of MMA fighters that get into pro wrestling realize that it's a lot harder than they expected. And I'm going to cite a recent example. When King Mo the Wall signed simultaneously, first time ever, with both Bellator and TNA to be the first guy to fight in two organizations at the same time, essentially a publicity stunt to try to get, you know, some extra eyes on the product, he started training up in OVW in Kentucky. And he even said in interviews, like, you know, it was a lot more grueling than his MMA training. You know, you're getting dropped, you're taking back bumps, you know, a couple hundred a day, I can imagine, if not more. Yeah. I mean, it's – I think a lot of people, like Ron Watermelon, you know, to train to fight.
You call him Watermelon?
Might last a couple of minutes.
Yeah, you just called him Ron Watermelon.
Well, you know. Sorry. hey, maybe it was a Freudian slip. But, you know, to train for taking on some of these schlubs in the Midwest regional scene, that probably didn't take that much out of him. But to get in there and wrestle, if your heart's not into it, it's going to show in the ring. And you're not going to make it in the wrestling industry unless you're, you know, dedicated.
That's true. And
are lucky.
And for that contract that King Mo signed, exactly how many matches has he had in TNA?
He's made appearances, but he's actually not had a sanctioned match in wrestling.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think...
And I don't know that that's going to happen anytime soon. I think they bit off more than they could chew, and when he realized how demanding it was, his pipe dream of growing up being a Ric Flair fan, blah, 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 you know, just not cut out for it.
Yeah, I mean, although one guy that is sort of successful in doing that is Lashley.
Yeah.
And which is, I mean, I haven't watched any of his MMA, but I'm really surprised he's able to pull off both at the same time.
Well,
I almost feel like I'm actually ready for him to just kind of leave wrestling behind and just stick with MMA at this point.
it's the gamble
of the WWE version of ECW that's left me bitter at him.
I
sorry,
think so, probably.
Sorry, Lashley.
Yeah, yeah. I did say on our last podcast he's quietly, because TNA, nobody's watched it, and probably record lows this past year, but he's quietly had a pretty unassuming nice run in TNA this year. He's had a couple good to great matches, but you know, I'm afraid for him to do that, Tim, because I think the illusion of, you know, currently I believe he's still undefeated. Maybe he's lost one fight, I'm not sure. Sooner or later he's going to run into tough competition and really get pressed in MMA. And the heavyweight fighters that are good in mixed martial arts are dangerous guys.
Yeah.
You know. And Lashley could get put on his back pretty quick with some top-level talent.
You and I have disagreed over this in the past when we discussed it, like during UFC events or whatever, but kind of along that line of thinking, I've noticed that UFC fighters do not have a shelf life at all. Like, you know, you get like maybe a year or two out of Chuck Liddell. I mean, Randy Couture has actually stuck around a very, very long time. But I've actually been advocating for a rule change in UFC, sort of taking inspiration from WWF or WWE or whatever they call themselves now. basically, I would advocate a rule change that in title fights, if it goes the distance, the belt stays with the champion.
Hmm.
The reason for that would actually be to make it a little easier for the promoters to build a brand around your champion. So you can, yes, the deck is stacked slightly in their favor, but it also means that the challenger has to fight harder. They can't just survive the champion. They have to beat the champion.
And it also allows for that rematch.
Yeah.
I see where you're going, and I think, and I'm not entirely like against what you're saying, but I think the stats would actually show in your favor that and they mentioned this on commentary. They acknowledge this. Typically in a title fight, it seems like the judges do score kind of towards the champion, especially if it comes down to a decision. It seems like to actually beat the champion, you have to really beat the champion definitively. So unless you're like going to clean his clock and kind of have your way with him for five rounds, chances are the champion's going to win. Not always the case, but most of the time, and I don't have statistical data, but I would imagine, you know, a good 80% of the time in a decision the champ retains.
It's usually the way it goes. At least it was the way in boxing.
But you're absolutely right about a short shelf life. Current fighters, you know, there's so many people currently signed in the UFC roster that it's difficult for them to get as many fights as they would like per year. And if you are on a two-fight losing streak in the UFC, you basically are facing the executioner's axe. You know, that could be your career. Yeah, so every fight is important, unless you have a really great winning personality that's going to maybe make you interesting, a crazy haircut, or you're in, you know, great on the microphone, something to keep you relevant. But if you lose, you know, two fights, especially consecutively, you might be facing deep waters.
Yeah, and you were just talking about being great on the microphone. This UFC 10, what we were just watching, some of the interviews that some of the pre-fight interviews, man, those were horrible. What did Don Fry say? He said, "Lock up your women and children. I'm here to fight," or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not a nice guy, which is funny because this is like earlier on this show, they did a live interview with him where it sounded like he was running for political office. Like, you know, it was like, that guy's a great fighter and I respect that guy. And then they go do this pre-taped thing, you know, where it's like, and I'm a dangerous fighter and lock up your women and children. Hide your kids, hide your wives. You know,
it's then you had Tank Abbott on the same show saying that Don the Dragon Wilson, who was USC commentator at the time, called him Don the Dragonfly Wilson, and he was making a Godzilla remake or doing a Godzilla voiceover that nobody would see except if they were watching TV at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, you referred to Shamrock as Glamrock and Severn as what was his name? The lead singer of Queen.
Freddie Mercury.
So at least he had a couple brain cells left in his head at that point to make a pun.
It
wouldn't be too long before he couldn't do that even.
Yeah, and then speaking of people that had jumped from UFC to pro wrestling, Tank Abbott, back in the dying days of WCW, jumped and actually...
He tried to give somebody a shave.
He tried to give somebody a shave, and that was...
Well, there's two different things about Tank Abbott's work in World Championship Wrestling. One... Like, when he was with 3Count, which was a boy band, I don't know, you know, for people that didn't watch that era of WCW, that was actually funny. It was a laugh. This juxtaposition of this, you know, pot-bellied biker guy, you know, with a giant goatee, you know, next to, you know, these guys in fluorescent green pants that were singing boy band songs. That was funny, okay? Maybe for a couple entertaining segments. Maybe wore out its welcome. But the flip side of it, before that, when they were trying to book him as a killer... That shit was not flying, man. I'm sorry.
If there was ever a man who was not cut out for the pro wrestling lifestyle, I mean, I don't think he could have run the ropes if he had to. I mean, he might have made it to one and the other and then gassed.
And they tried to protect him, and...
they even tried to book
Adam, do you remember there was a... I think it was a Steiner versus Steiner match, or... on a pay-per-view where Tank like popped one of them in the chin, and
it was the last Great American Bash. It was the 2000 Great American Bash. It was in this. This is like one of two most notable things that Tank ever did, and the other one was just outside of the ring in WCW. They were in this asylum, this little circular cage that fit inside the ring. It was Rick Steiner and Tank Abbott against Scott Steiner.
Yeah.
It only went like three or four minutes, and it was just god awful.
May have been the worst thing on a terrible show. And you know, we mentioned this kind of faux cage, this kind of, you know, so what about the one in WWE as well? Where they kind of constructed a little miniature octagon.
You're talking about the Lion's Den match?
Well, there was the Lion's Den. Yeah, the Lion's Den match.
I never got it. I didn't understand what the rules were.
I think it was supposed to be just like a vehicle to get Shamrock over.
Okay.
Kind of base the pit off of the UFC octagon.
Yeah.
And show him that he's, you know, Shamrock's is a great pit fighter and he's real tough in this, you know, cage fighting. I think it was meant as a vehicle to get Shamrock over.
They only
did a handful of them, I think, right, Brian?
Yeah, I can only think of that real one offhand. Maybe there were others. But, you know, Vince recently came out, the CM Punk interview, that's the kind of the flavor of the week.
Someone's going to die.
Yeah, one of the things he said is that Vince McMahon said UFC was barbaric and someone was going to die. That makes me think of Brawl for It All. I mean, clearly that was them trying to, you know, why else would they have been motivated to do that? Such an outlandish, you know.
Wait a minute, you're telling me we've just convinced all of them that the wrestling is a work, and now you're going to try to convince them this part's a shoot, and I don't understand. Sorry, that's my Cornette portion of them.
Yeah, well, no, that's that point that, yeah, if that was Cornette made the point, it's the same one that was on the law of our lips.
I think it was supposed to be one of these things that we got Dr. Death over as a you know, legitimate tough guy, but no, he got knocked the fuck out, and like,
oh, he got his clock clean, man. His eyes were
round.
His eyes were so glassy.
And they actually got a legit winner when Bart Gunn, and what do? They feed him to Butterbean, and just, like, why would you do that?
And he gets knocked out in, like, 30 seconds at WrestleMania, and he's never heard from in the U.S. wrestling scene. Again, no, I take that back. He was in TNA briefly in 2003, but aside from that, he was never hardly heard from in the U.S. wrestling scene again. He got beat so bad on at WrestleMania. He started a whole new career in Japan.
Yeah.
Well, Bart Gunn, his eyes got more glazed than a donut ring, man. here's a funny little UFC trivia bit for you guys. UFC 100, their big pay-per-view, was not the 100th show
that one
by any means. And so the little talked about the little show that could UFC 78 Validation. Was actually the 100th UFC show, headlined by two Ultimate Fighter alums, Michael Bisping and Rashad Evans. So there's one to look up if you're feeling lonely.
Interesting. One other thing I think we should mention, since we're on the topic of since you just mentioned Ultimate Fighter, is the I guess this could kind of be construed as the early days, as it kind of helped UFC kind of.
If you're talking about the Stephen Bonner, Forrest Griffin match, I mean, it certainly, I think it's what led to a lot of their mainstream popularity.
It is. It kind of got them out of the dark ages and kind of got them back into that mainstream.
Oh, absolutely.
The number one of all time on the, I think it was a couple years ago, on the UFC top 100 fights of all time.
Well, kind of, you know, for me, Adam, going back to, you know, I actually got to catch UFC 1 live. I was following that season of The Ultimate Fighter, and I watched the finale live, and wow, you know, I don't know that I've went back and actually watched that fight in its entirety since, and I don't really want to, because I don't want to spoil that original, you know, viewing, that screening of it. I remember my brother came down the steps when I was living in the basement, and just to catch up, I'm like, man, sit down, dude. I was like, you have to see what's going on. This fight is nuts. These guys, it's a barn burner. And sure enough, he walked in about halfway through it and couldn't leave until it was done, because, you know, it was just a great brawl in the truest sense of the – but also on that same show, to kind of tie us back to our topic of history, Ken Shamrock's final UFC fight, getting his ass whipped by a local boy, done good, Rich Franklin, a guy who I've ran into more than once here in Cincinnati, but he's moved out west now to start a juice business.
The juice business.
Start a juice bar. Hey, man. Yeah. But, so yeah, you know, you kind of had a little taste of the past on a show that was seen by a ton of people.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's
you had a big leap forward into the future. And that kind of was like, from that moment on, I've been, just like I mainline my WWE, you know, it's in my blood. From that show on, I haven't turned a blind eye to the UFC since.
No, and I think...
enjoying the ride.
I think you and I, Tim, I think we were just kind of, you were just hanging out with me one day, and we were just flipping through channels, and we just happened to come across that.
Yeah.
And we just stopped everything we were doing, and we watched that fight, and that fight just glued us right back into UFC.
Yeah, because I had tried to watch a little bit of The Ultimate Fighter, and about the point where they started pissing on each other's beds and stuff like that, I was... there was a point in my life, and I'm not there anymore, there was a point where I considered myself a martial artist, and to see a show where martial artists are behaving like children on national television, it offended me in a deep way, and I didn't want to watch it anymore, so I stopped watching The Ultimate Fighter, so, but that pulled me back in, so.
Yeah, the one thing about the show, which is, you know, in its 20th season, at least the American version, there's been several international ones now, also available on their Fight Pass network, but is that, you know, at the end of the day, hijinks aside, and there always is drama within the house, and, you know, it gets pretty trite. You know, at the end of the day, the guys have to fight it out, or girls also now.
Which I should mention that actually my cousin, Jessamine Duke, was on The Ultimate Fighter.
Really?
Yeah, that's something, too. Give our NHO podcast a little rub. Adam's cousin is one of the four horsewomen of MMA underneath Ronda Rousey.
She's my... fourth cousin on my...
Well, get her on the podcast.
Yeah.
I don't know her that well. I don't even think I've ever met her. But I just know she's my cousin.
Come on, we can get some family dirt in here.
We might be able to. I'll see what I can...
Yeah, let's pull some strings. But no, so... here's a minor... This is a very, very minor rant. I just want to throw it out there because I've never had a forum to do it before. I read a lot of MMA sites, you know, Bloody Elbow, all these MMA Junkie, MMA Fighting. And these international Ultimate Fighter programs, the Latin America one just ended. There's been three in Brazil. There was one in China, which was hands down the worst. I've seen them all. There was, you know, the Smashes season, which was UK versus Australia. I've watched all these. A lot of these reporters, guys that are actually getting paid to follow and write about the sport on the daily, will turn up their nose and say, well... you know, yeah, this recent show, UFC 180, almost all the prelims featured guys from the Mexico, you know, versus Latin America tough season. But we didn't watch any of the episodes. It's like, if you're getting paid to watch, you know, MMA, you should probably watch the Ultimate Fighter seasons. Just my two cents. Because I'm watching them, and I'm just a fan. But a lot of people don't watch the international ones. It's easy, you know. Fight Pass makes it all available, so...
Well, it's funny because with regard to MMA journalists, there was a girl on The Escapist, Lisa Foyles, would do top five with Lisa Foyles every week, and I was a big fan of that show where she would just do top five things related to video gaming. And she actually just recently left The Escapist and now hosts a show on UFC.com, kind of recapping the women's Ultimate Fighter stuff. So,
she's called the UFC Minute, and it's actually she the entire company every day. It's usually between 60 to 80 seconds long. She'll run down any headlines. She'll run down any fight announcements. She'll also plug any articles or new video content on the site that day. Preview upcoming programs and fights. She's a great host. I mean, sorry for the loss to that other group, but I never knew her prior to this, but I think she's great.
Well, I think she also worked out a lot of the kinks on The Escapist, because her show, when she first started it, was not good. It took her about a year or two for it to really hit its stride, and when it left, though, it became one of my favorite shows. It was one of the ones, along with Movie Bob and Zero Punctuation, I always looked forward to every week. So and I miss it. I'd said at the time when she made the jump that, okay, I'm kind of a UFC fan as well. I'll try to keep up with it, but I have not.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I mean, hopefully some people out there will think as fondly about the NHO podcast as you did about those shows, man. That would be great.
I think we're getting too close to the end of the show here. Kind of closing out the show here. I know we veered off topic a little bit. We stayed on UFC. We kind of got into the modern era. But jumping back to the original days,
mm-hmm.
Do you guys think that this period holds up now over time? If you were to go back and watch a random show, let's say UFC 17, okay, and compare it to one of today's mega shows, like I think there's a pay-per-view coming up soon, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, December 6th, this Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to compare it to a pay-per-view nowadays, does it really hold up? Does it hold its
Tim, do you want to take the first crack at this?
Well, they're like completely different shows now.
Yeah.
So I don't. It's almost like there's not really much of a comparison. I mean, you know, it's not a karate guy versus a sumo wrestler anymore. It's guys who have trained to be MMA fighters. MMA is its own style now,
mm-hmm.
And so now you're just kind of. It's no longer a science experiment to see what would work on a street fight. It's about who is the best MMA fighter. And
right. Yeah, you're not showing up at the building and not knowing who you're fighting. You're spending an 8-week training camp, sometimes longer, specifically training for one particular opponent.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. They have completely different audiences. So do they hold up? I don't know. I feel like your modern UFC fan would probably be bored by the original UFC matches.
They probably would, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, despite the fact that they had the reputation for being, you know, bare-knuckle brawls and stuff like that, so many of those fights, like you mentioned, Brian, did end in submission, and the, you know, knockouts were kind of few and far between. And, you know, you have these battles between Shamrock and Gracie where they just kind of lay on the mat and, you know, don't move.
Yeah.
So I feel like they would not be thrilled by that show, but that was also the show that I preferred, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my favorite time period as well. I know I mentioned it in the previous two episodes, but you hit a good point, Tim, to where they are two completely different animals. If you look at a show from the SEG area, particularly one of the early ones, like the, you know, 8, 9, or even 10 or 11, they all have sort of character. The arenas are lit. You see the people in the crowd. There's a stage. You know, everything's well lit, and there's, you know, you get these wacky characters and everything that we didn't even get a chance to touch on, some of the wild characters, like Chemo and Harold Howard and people like that. But if you watch a UFC pay-per-view nowadays, the arena's dark. And they all kind of look the same. You can't tell whether you're in Cincinnati or Louisville or Los Angeles.
That's probably done intentionally.
That's what I'm thinking. It's probably done intentionally to keep the action more. It's like Mid-South wrestling, and like Bill Watts did back in WCW. He dimmed down the lights. You didn't see the crowd. The action was just on the ring.
Well, I imagine it's also to try to hide if there are ever any empty seats.
That's true. That's probably, yeah, too. But I think they just can't keep the action focused on the...
You know, I think for historical perspective, I think they are certainly important. And I think, you know, now with, like, UFC Fight Pass, you know, people can go back and take a look at them, and there's value in that. But I think without the lens, you know, through the glasses, you know, the lens of nostalgia, I don't know that they hold up particularly well. You know, my preference would be today's product. You've got, like, just in the terms of technique, how far it's came, you got guys doing essentially springboards off the sides of the cages now.
Yes.
You have, you know, incredible techniques. We're still seeing submissions broken out that blow Joe Rogan's mind that have never been done before in the, you know, almost 20-year history of the company. Some of the knockouts in the past few years, spin wheel kicks and things, are just remarkable. But Adam, I think this is also an interesting point, is that, like, old wrestling, like, I like to stay current on my MMA and my pro wrestling, because it's like that, it's absolutely soap opera. It's the woman that's, you know, the housewife that's home 5 days a week and watching her shows, her stories. You know, I like to stay current, but I can go back and watch wrestling from last year. I can go back and watch wrestling from 10 years ago. I can go back and watch wrestling from 45 years ago, and I still can get pulled in. But I think I would have a harder time watching some, you know, MMA from 20 years ago. I don't know, you know, knowing the results doesn't really heart me when I go back and watch WrestleMania 4.
Yes,
but you know,
different.
Watching UFC 4 might be a tougher task for me. I might have to do the Clockwork Orange thing and Pride the Islands Open.
I'm kind of with you there. I mean, I can't go back and watch all those old UFC shows. There are a number of them where I like to go back and watch. Like, I think I mentioned UFC 6 and 14. Mm-hmm. And Sutton, I think even UFC 17 is a very good show to go back and watch because it has your debut of Chuck Liddell, your debut of Dan Henderson. I think those shows are historically important. Mm-hmm. If not, you know, it's kind of to where MMA started to evolve, and those from like UFC 14 and 15 and going up to where Zuffa bought it, it started to evolve into what we see as today. So I think it's important, even though the shows may not hold up over time, I think it's important to at least go back and revisit some of those early shows to see where you were, to see where it's been, and so you know where you know where you are today, to know where you've come from.
Yeah, that's true. I think as somebody who's very much a fan of today's product, I do owe it to myself to go back. Some of those, you know, teen shows, the 15, 16, 25, some of those shows that if I've seen, which I may not have, it's been since, you know, they were first out on video, and a lot of those didn't make it to video. So, yeah, I definitely feel like that's a gap in my fandom. I also want to say, too, to anybody that's watching that maybe is a fan of the old stuff but not the new or just not in general, today's UFC, a good way to kind of dip your toes in the water, like not just on Fight Pass but on their free YouTube channel, they do a remarkable job of building up the fights in the days and weeks of in advance. Everything from training stuff to interviews, which give you a glimpse into the personality of the fighters, kind of get to know them in lieu of the fight happening. Even the weigh-in specials, I tune into all the weigh-in specials now. It's great, you know, the day before they actually fight, getting on the scales and then, you know, facing off. That moment when their eyes lock is sometimes electric, and so it might take a little bit more groundwork, but you can, if you put in the time, you can really get pulled into the fights and get really excited come fight night.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think at this point we're going to call it a show here. It's starting to get a little bit late, and I need to get up at 6 a.m. for work.
Yes.
I want to thank you for joining us today. Hope you've enjoyed yourself here on the podcast.
Indeed.
Maybe we can do this again sometime soon. Brian, hopefully next week we can have – I'm trying to line up a guest for next week, as I mentioned last week. I have not heard back on a confirmation date yet, so –
Yeah, I mean, we got we want to go semi-reg, so, you know, we're hoping to kick in your ears every 7 to 10 days, hopefully, on NHO Podcast.
Yeah, if we...
So we're going to stay on top of current product. I know, Adam, we've been talking about doing a grab bag show where we kind of talk about what we're watching, and I'm finally getting some, carving out some free time to watch more and more wrestling, so here soon I'd like to talk just about some of the random stuff I've been watching. Also, it just kind of hit me, Adam, as we were talking earlier about Great American Bash, maybe not specifically that event, but through email, we should kind of go back and forth and pick out maybe a pay-per-view or some sort of show that we could cover in its entirety over the next, you know, year or however long on the podcast here and there.
I think that
that might be a fun exploration.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm trying to line us up, I guess, for next week. If not, we'll do a grab bag show. Or maybe just kind of a show like we've done the past couple weeks, just talking different topics, thoughts, and, you know, just kind of a mixed bag. So
we'll is it all snow?
No.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what's lining up. We'll see what's lining up for TLC this Saturday.
Tim, if you can get Al Snow on the show for us, that would be great.
I'm sure that I'll just steal head.
Or even get the head. I think getting Al Snow's head on the show, that just
sounds... Describe him with hockey jerseys. That's an obscure WWE confidential reference, if there ever was one. But no, this weekend's UFC 181, and it's also Final Battle in New York City, ROH's first ever live pay-per-view. So next week, this time, we will definitely have some things to talk about.
Final Battle's going to be a wild show.
Adam Rose is always something to talk about.
Oh my gosh.
So anyway, Adam, did I ever make you watch Overtime, the Al Snow movie?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Where Al Snow and this guy get locked in a nuclear silo?
Yeah. It's basically Left 4 Dead, except with Al Snow.
I think this should be a podcast topic soon.
Movies?
Movies starring wrestlers.
That is a great movie. It is not a bad movie.
Okay.
I finally plunked down my 2 bits and got a Roku, so now I can watch my WWE main event and WWE superstars on my big screen 60-inch plasma.
You know, plus your UFC Fight Pass, so...
Yes, all the Curtis Axel 5-minute matches I could ever want are now at my disposal.
That's right. You know,
prepare yourself for a long night of Curtis Axel matches. And on that point, guys, we're going to get out of here. So thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, man. See you guys. Knuckle up.